Welcome to the Ralph Moore Podcast. Gain a leadership advantage as Ralph pulls wisdom from his bag of over 50 years' experience in planting and leading multiplying churches. Our goal is to help you live as a leader you'd want to follow. You'll learn about making disciples and planting churches, but beyond that, you'll gain practical wisdom about subjects like how to manage your team, handling difficult people, pulling a congregation off a growth plateau, and even money management.
Hi, welcome to the podcast. This is part two of my interview with Daniel Williams of the Calvary Chapel of West Palm Beaches, Florida. And Daniel just told about starting a church in a bar, doing it bivocationally. We get in this part to how he processed money, and so important for guys that are in that kind of situation.
So how long a time from when you landed in Florida to when that event happened, and how did you fund your life in between? Because I think vocational, these issues are what we have to address as we are going to move forward. And I think the luxury, because here's what I hear, the luxury of not having to do Sunday from the beginning. I mean, you're going to end up doing Sunday or Tuesday night or whatever you're going to do, but not having to do that, which doesn't hang some kind of expectation around your neck. And in reality, you're actually doing the gospel. You get to evangelize and make disciples, and eventually a church will fall out of it. A friend of mine quoted me recently, and I don't remember if I ever said it. He said, Ralph Moore always says that if you plant a church, you may not necessarily make disciples. But if you make disciples, you will eventually plant a church. And, I'm not really sure if he heard that from somebody else and not me. But I think there's great wisdom in that. But I think what it really underscores is that Jesus didn't go and start a church. When I think you got to look at Acts chapter 1 and 2 and go, there was 120 people in the church in Jerusalem that Jesus left behind. But Jesus didn't go and plant a church in Jerusalem. He went and healed people, because we forget the supernatural. Every person in the Bible who got serious about God, there was some encounter with God or a healing. And I think, you know, I had a friend once, I made a joke about being a recovering Pentecostal. He's a Baptist, and he's a big shot in the Baptist. And he wheeled on me and turned around and pointed at me and said, don't say that. I'm trying to become one. In other words, I'm a Baptist, but I understand that the things of the Spirit and the power, there has to be what John Wimber called power encounters. So you got that, you got the power encounter, then you got the following Jesus, then you got the learning from Jesus as he taught, and eventually a church tumbled out, and eventually the church tumbled out of it. And so that, to me, it's a luxury to do it the right way. And almost everybody does it the wrong way. You know, you get funding, you go in, you start an event, and then you hope to make some disciples around the event, because a Sunday event isn't a church. A church is a web of relationships that are rooted in, hopefully, in disciple making. So how are you funded? And then talk us through, you know, what all happened. This is exciting. Yeah. I'm having fun talking to you.
Yeah. So my story, I think more people are amazed because it's a parachute plan. I went 3,000 miles. And if I would have gone, you know, any other direction, I would have been called a missionary. However, because I was still in the U.S., that didn't happen. The mindset, I think, is so important. And even listeners are for church planning. I knew that coming from the get-go, being a parachute plant, I wanted to build relational through the gospel. That takes time. You plant, and then you get fruit in a different season. So what ends up happening is I already knew from the get-go I'd be 3 to 5 years behind. Because I could have taken over a church in Washington State. I could have pastored with my relationships there and even started something differently. But I knew God was calling me to do this. So my mindset was, we start with the gospel. I'll go get a job. My example from my dad, God's sovereign, right? All these little pieces and stories. He was a bivocational church planner. Sure. So So I knew, okay, I'll go get a job. In college, what I did was I sold women's shoes at Nordstrom. Well, then when I went to Florida, I sold women's shoes at Bloomingdale's. People ask me why women's shoes, because women buy more shoes than men. Okay. So I would wear a suit to work every week, selling shoes. I would get off at 6 o'clock. My open mic would start at 7. I'd get off, be there at 6:30, change, have an open mic from 7 to 10 PM. And you try to build systems of evangelism and intentional plan to meet people, to be out, to pray, and really rely on the Holy Spirit to guide you and lead you. And so my funding was not there. We had a few personal family friends that supported us. They knew what we were doing, but in the Calvary Chapel world, sometimes we haven't done the best as far as equipping, funding. They just, all right, God's in it. They lay hands on you. I have my certificate, ordination, and we just left. And one cool thing, and I think the greatest resource are people. At the time, I did not know exactly where I was going to land. I knew that God was calling us to plant a church, and I was discipling another guy who was really had a missionary heart as well. He was going to Jordan, Israel, that area, for a mission trip on summer. And so before we left, I said, hey, would you pray about coming? Because I wanted to have at least a team. I had my wife, I had my children, they were 3 and 1. But so he went to Jordan, Israel, and I said, listen, I don't know exactly where we're going. I had this time been getting visions. God had been telling me and directing me, sort of, I was going to be ministering to East Coast people. It was the coast. But I said, listen, God's going to direct me and tell me where to go. Buy a one-way ticket to Orlando and I'll pick you up. The Lord had revealed to me he was going to tell me where we were going to go at this certain conference, this training, where I actually met a mutual friend, Peyton Jones. And so I went to California to go get training. And he went to Jordan, Israel, that area region. The Lord directed me, audibly told me this, the city. And so when he came back from Jordan to Orlando, I picked him up and we went in together. He actually lived with me for a year and a half as we were planting. And so we had relationships, and that's probably the greatest resource. Statistics say that. I think NAM is actually telling that. It's like, it's not if you launch with 500,000 or a million. If you could have a mentor, someone mentoring you and coaching you, and you have relationships around you, those are your greatest resources. And that's what actually helped a church. So I would say that was our funding. We had the backing, authority, and coaching and mentorship. We had training, but we also had people just coming alongside of us, believing in the work.
So unpack the open mic. What was that? What was that all about? How'd you do that? Where'd you do that?
Yeah, it was downtown. So a lot of people gather in our city. In Florida, there's not very many downtowns, but in Delray Beach, there was. And so my wife and I, we are gifted in music and would play shows at festivals, stuff like that. But you're playing 3-hour sets. People ask, do you play worship songs? I say, absolutely not. We're playing Bob Marley. You're playing love songs, those type of things. But I found out, rather than playing a 3-hour set with just little breaks and entertaining people, being a hub in the community and making space for other people. And so the reason why I did an open mic is I could play 3 hours of just, you know, my own music and covers, but we would facilitate other people. And then when they would do a 15-minute slot, I would just MC, hey, now next we have Ralph, you know, he's a great guitar player and singer, and he's going to share some songs. And then we would build community from that. And so it was trying to find those things, and we would do anything, I mean, short of sin, to reach people. I joined a kickball team, open mics. I would even specifically not get plugged into a Sunday morning church because I wanted to know where the people were at on Sunday morning that did not know Jesus. People that knew Jesus were in church, but I was like, well, where are the people that are not knowing Jesus? So, and then we started from a community group, not only in our home, but I found out a lot of people were skeptic of coming into your home, not knowing them. So we had to create third spaces where people can go. So we had a Bible study on Thursday night for a Bible study on Thursday night at a community center. And we would just evangelize, invite people in the park right by it. And half the time people would just stumble in because they thought it was an AA meeting or an NA meeting. Because it's recovery is so saturated. Delray Beach was heralded by the New York Times as the recovery center of the world. There are over 3,000 AA meetings going on a month.
Wow.
And so oftentimes if you gather people in a park or in a little community center and there's, you know, 20, 30, whatever people, they're probably assuming it's a meeting.
Yeah.
All right. So yeah, we would just try to systematically make way to build relationship, and through that relationship, share the gospel, have barbecues, have friends, like all that different stuff to meet people and to plant in those type of ways.
Wow, that's really, really good. I want you to get into now, I love hearing about the vision that your wife had about the small pipe and the big leaky pipe.
Yeah.
I want you to talk about the merger. I want you to tell, first I want you to tell, you've told about the church that you were in, the small pipe. By the way, what happened with that Easter deal? Before we get into that, I want, you know, where people ask you, are you going to hold a thing on Easter? What happened? How did it unfold from there into actually being a church?
Well, I had at that time, because we were doing the open mic, I had gathered around 8 to 10 people. Half of those were just brand new Christians. We were discipling them. A few were just displaced Christians. And so I had called a community center and I had said, hey, I need a spot. Would you be interested in opening up on Easter or, you know, on this Sunday? They didn't know it was Easter. And they said, you know, what's funny is every single Sunday's booked besides that Sunday. And they said, but, you know, after that, you can actually meet during the week on nighttime if you'd like, because I think our community does need some, like a Bible study or something. And it was one of the only nights that was free is available that I wasn't working. So God made provision for the space. And it was a smaller space. And, you know, so we just, I designed 5,000 flyers. We started, got our core team to pray and just made space. We had two services because it was a smaller space. I didn't know what I was thinking. I didn't know if 50 people would show up, 5 people would show up, or 500. And so by faith, we just had two services in this community center. And those friends came and I was able to share the gospel. And we even had one Haitian guy who worked a 16-hour day the day before. And he said, God woke me up today to get saved at your church.
Wow.
Before service, I said, well, I'm going to preach the gospel and I'll give you a chance to, you know, explain who Jesus is and what he's done. And he said, okay. And so, you know, I'm wrapping up my message and you know, the typical altar call moment or whatever. And he almost interrupts me, raises his hand. He goes, is this the time now? Can I get saved? And so we would have a lot of God stories like that. We had one really good friend now. They were planning a church 2 months, 3 months later in February. And their whole core team came just to see what we were doing. And God then just started bringing people.
This was Easter. And then you started doing nighttime. What night of the week were you meeting?
Meeting Thursday nights. And we did that from Easter to April to about January. We launched Sundays, not until January.
So I want to say something here to anybody who's listening. There, for one thing, that and Daniel didn't do this. We're not talking about Daniel. I'm just talking about you guys. I'm currently attending a mega church in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And they ran out of space on Sunday morning. Actually, they didn't. They still have quite a bit of space on Sunday morning. A lot of empty seats and vast auditorium. But they decided that there are people whose needs aren't being met on Sunday because they work on Sundays. They started Thursday night church. I just talked to somebody recently they're starting a church on Sunday night. One of the things that we're always struggling with when we start churches is, where do we meet? And I would just want to point out to anybody who's listening that church buildings sit empty other than Sundays and Wednesdays. And you can get them Sunday night. For one thing about Sunday night is they already made the messes on the floor. If you rent it on Saturday night, they're going to be mad at you when they show up on Sunday because you made the mess. But if you meet on Sunday night, that works great. Thursday night and Tuesday night are wonderful nights. You know, I know people who are taking over churches. One of my friends is starting a real estate investment, like a REIT, and they're buying churches. They'll go to a church that's dying and they'll buy the church, but then they guarantee the people who are there, the 12 or 14 old people, that we're going to maintain your service for you in this church and we'll supply a pastor, we'll do everything, but we're going to fix the building up and we're going to rent it out to five different churches. And, you know, they'll, especially what we look at, what we call ethnic churches, you know, Filipino church, they're willing to meet any time of the week. They don't have a lot of money. I know a Russian language church that rents to a Japanese church during the week. So this is crucial, what Daniel is saying here. And I think it's also crucial that it was a community center. I would far rather start in a community center than in a church building. And I would far rather start now that I know what I know. I've always done it on Sundays. The last one was in a movie theater on Sundays. You can't get a movie theater on Thursday night. But Sunday morning before they open, we were able to have. So, and we did three services in that situation. I think that we just got to think out of the box because the world has changed so much. But this idea of I make friends, I make disciples, those disciples get evangelized, because I think it goes this way. You make a friend, they become your disciple before they become Jesus' disciple, because it's follow me as I follow Christ. You walk them into Christ. Then a church falls out of the deal. Starting micro, you know, what we call micro church, to me is a great tool for starting a mega church if you're gonna. It's a great church, great tool for starting a lot of micro churches too. But it can kind of go either way. I'm thrilled to hear of what you did. I want us to shift gears a little bit now and get into the merger, because usually mergers result in the death of one side or the other of the merger. And you've had success. And what did you guys do? I mean, you told us what you did beforehand and asking everybody to pray for a word from the Lord. I think that's huge. What did you do right and what did you do wrong? What were the greatest things that are victories? How long have you been in it? And then, you know, what are the biggest obstacles that you've had to overcome? And what do you think the future holds?
Yeah, I think with the merge, sometimes the things you do wrong, you don't even know you do wrong until you look back, reflect. And I'm sure that there's many lessons like that.
And nobody that I know has ever got up in the morning and said, I think I'm going to make a mistake today. Let's go for it.
Yeah.
You always think you're doing the right thing and then it blows up on you.
Yeah. I think God's hand has been so good and kind. I think the success of seeing people just come and being drawn through the Holy Spirit and people getting saved, and God gave me a word to say, Daniel, be yourself. And I think what ends up happening in a lot of successions or even mergers is, you know, he was a prominent African-American man, 70 years old. I'm mixed, but I'm 40, you know, and different person. And so there's a great temptation to try to be someone that you're not, or try to appease people. And I just trust that the Holy Spirit will allow me to minister to whoever I'm supposed to minister to. And if this is according to God's plan, he wants me to be myself, and I have to walk through that. And so I think one of the things right from the very beginning, the early successes, for me anyway, was having the confidence that God had called me to this. Because, you know, when you have a great calling, you know that you're going to be in a great spiritual warfare. There's going to be great obstacles. You're going to need that calling, because it's going to get hard and you're going to have to go back to it.
Right.
So God directed us, because there was a lot of miracles and supernatural situations to say, let's move forward. But yet there was a lot of obstacles. And probably the biggest obstacle was preferences. I think that's like with anything. It's a very multi-ethnic, multi-generational church. So being a primarily African-American pastor, congregation, half of those were from Jamaica, which is a difference sure. than being African-American. Even though my dad was African-American, coming from the islands is totally different culture. Then we have Hispanics, then we have whites, then we have old, we have young. I had not been in a situation where I've been pastoring this many people in a certain situation. They were about 100, we were about 50. Merging the two, all of a sudden you have different dynamics. So being able to think quickly and being flexible, not basing off of your experience for the systems. I recently heard every 20% your church grows, you need to restructure how you do things. So being quick to say, okay, God, I don't know who's in my life that I can get help from has been really critical, really good to get the encouragement, to get some wisdom on that. And then just, you know, understanding, okay, this is a part of God's plan, having confidence in that. So big challenges from the get-go, at least with ours, is it's a little bit unique. Like you said, most merges are that smaller churches dying and unhealthy. I had to proactively kill my church. Okay. And so even though I became now the president, the CEO, the lead pastor, all the stuff over me, we didn't stay with Redemption Church or Redemption Church of the Palm Beaches. The Lord said, unless you want to bear fruit, a seed must fall to the ground and die. I wanted to come with honor and with humility. And so we kept Calvary Chapel of the Palm Beaches name. We had to transfer all the legal stuff that was really hard, the bank accounts, the dying, the obstacles for us were there was a big leadership gap. And not only from the lead pastor, but other leaders. And so that was a big challenge, still is, as we're growing and we're trying to build and train. The culture that we had is we celebrate multiplication. Other churches, we do a lot of other kingdom stuff in our area. I'm a part of the network of Church United. I'm helping plant churches that aren't even a part of our denomination, all this different stuff that wasn't a part of their culture. And so I had a different approach, and I still do. Rather than leading with my mission, vision, and values, I'm going to live that out for them. And so by the time I actually say them with my words, they're going to already have seen it.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe and check his blog at ralphmoore.net.